Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to this week's episode of Safe Room, a horror video game podcast and proud member of Bloody Disgusting's Bloody FM podcast network. I'm your host, Jay Krieger.
And I'm the other one, Neil Bow.
And this week's chat has been a long time coming, 2 years in fact, as this week's game was our very own Neil Bolt's Game of the Year for 2022, the game in question being Norco from developer Geography of Robots. This point-and-click adventure game is set within the southern gothic future of Norco, Louisiana, as protagonist Kay returns home after the death of her estranged mother, Catherine, and begins to investigate the disappearance of her brother, as well as the oil conglomerate Shield, whose negative influence has continued to spread throughout Norco. So over on Horror Bites, the trend had been set for quite a while now, where we were tackling a lot of text adventures. And while text adventure games and point-and-click adventure games are two separate genres, I think it's fair to say that they share a lot of similarities in the sense that, you know, for hopefully the very best examples of both genres would typically be very well written, tell very personable stories using genre to make those maybe more accessible to some people or just to explore narratives that maybe shy from the beaten path of kind of exactly what you'd expect. And then at the same time, you know, they utilize puzzles and key items and whatnot. And so, you know, while you and I are big fans of text adventures and point and click adventure games, I think sometimes like general audiences as a whole maybe have sort of like an antiquated view of them. You know what I mean? It's one of those genres where as games are getting bigger and bigger, I kind of don't see them as being as popular as some of the maybe more, I suppose, hyped genres, if you will. So I guess in brief, like what would your elevator pitch for Norco be to sell people on it that maybe aren't the biggest fans of point and click adventure games?
I suppose in a way, it would be to say is Norco is a point and click adventure for people who don't like point and click adventures, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's, you know, despite, you know, the majority of your time being spent clicking and talking as you would expect, I always found it quite impressive how they go about the story in a way that where it flits between styles, viewpoints, and tones without sort of divorcing it from what it actually is. And, you know, by doing that, it keeps you on your toes, keeps you doing different things. You don't get that problem you do often get if you aren't into visual novel style games or point and click games, because you know, this definitely has elements of both to it in its structure, where everything kind of feels like it's much for muchness, you're sort of going through the same thing. You know, it's not a loop, so to speak, which, you know, the gameplay loop that most games have, you know, where it's like this is what keeps me going, the thing that I'm interested in. It has to come either from the narrative really hooking you in, which always easy for people that don't like to read, and then you have the gameplay itself. It's like, now it doesn't all have to be head scratching puzzles and, you know, witty dialogue necessarily, but it's good to have a few different ways of playing the game, and this is very early on in Norco, you have this sort of mini game with you with your teddy from your childhood, your pet monkey thing, and literally just have to play like a staring contest mini game and stuff like that all the way through. It's much the same reason I like stuff like the Pulp Pixel stuff, you know, where it's like taking the visual novel thing, doing something a bit simple. You know, they had the card game thing, which is like a running joke at that point, but it's still throwing up different little gameplay styles in there. You know, like 1 minute you're trying to do a Frogger style card chase thing or whatever, and the next you're doing Defender, you know, all these sort of modern takes on retro games. And here, it's a more sophisticated version of that. And I think that at the core of this game, that's what really makes it like stand out from anything else in its field.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I've been a fan of both point-and-click adventure games and visual novels or text-based adventures. And, you know, I like elements of both while still thinking that both could have, I suppose, different takes or different utilizations of their mechanics that don't necessarily jive with me all the time. Because one of my big things with a lot of the sort of text adventures that we've covered on Horror Bites is that typically my, and I don't even know if I'd call it a complaint or a criticism, but one of my sort of like bucket lists is like, I always love the ones that incorporate sounds and visuals as well. And, you know, it's not to say like they all have to have these gorgeous sort of murals while the text is displaying on top of it, but it always just helps to kind of emphasize the creative's, I suppose, the like atmosphere of the story that they're telling, right? With primarily what I'm always thinking in the back of my mind is about The River Runs Through Us, which did such a fantastic job of having very personable writing, but it also had this fantastic score that captures the mood and the atmosphere. And then likewise, the visuals that go along with it are not distracting, but they just add so much more flavor to the world itself. And that's not to say that I haven't been enjoying certain text adventures, whether or not they have those features, but I always just in the back of my mind, I'm thinking this could have been so much better if they had utilized some of these other creative elements and whatnot, which are admittedly not required. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the basis of that subgenre. But at the same time, there's always that thing that I'm just like, man, this would have been even that much more engrossing or that much more engaging had it utilized those stylistic elements. And then when you talk about those point and click adventure games, for the most part, I'm thinking about, you know, playing catch up on a lot of those 90s era LucasArts games and whatnot. And for me, I always appreciated the writing. But as you said, you know, when you kind of have one foot firmly rooted in comedy with a lot of those types of games, it gets to be a little bit much when they try to make every line that's uttered have a punchline that's super memorable, or it's an inside joke or something along those lines, to the point that it almost becomes a little tiresome. Like the identity of the characters gets lost sometimes. And, oh, this person just is a comedian, so they're just going to make jokes the entire time, which makes it difficult for those characters to serve a purpose sometimes outside of the funny guy or the scientific guy type of thing. You kind of like prescribe these characters to their preset sort of tropes almost, if you will. And then at the same time, some of the puzzles can be really just like obscure or head scratching for the sake of it, which then can kind of like grind you down a little bit and whatnot, which again is like a me problem. But at the same time, it's the thing where I go into those experiences and I'm like, oh, I'm really digging this story, but I have to use a guide because sometimes when you're going back to those old games, it's like, oh, okay, you really had to think outside the box. You talk about thinking outside the box in modern puzzle games. Back in the day, it was a whole nother beast entirely. So I totally co-sign what you're saying about Norco being the best of both worlds and the fact that it's able to take those influences and modernize it in a way that doesn't necessarily kind of alter the experiences that it is blending together. You know, it very much is a case of this game utilizing the best case of visuals, music, and at the same time having really, really well done writing that gives you a sense of space, a sense of history, and a very personable sense of everything relating in terms of like characters, their trials and tribulations. But more importantly, like the setting itself is not just this unique set dressing. It really does factor into almost every single aspect of the game, from characters to plot to even the aesthetic choices that really are done in a way with this pixel art style that just it it captures that Southern Gothic mood so well.
It doesn't it just, as we said, it's a complete package in sort of getting that across. You know, I think, and it's a very particular sort of version of it as well, which is almost post-apocalyptic, but more likely apocalyptic. It's in the middle of, it's having its own little apocalypse where corporations have taken this place to, the doldrums and ruined it in a way. It's probably the most realistic depiction of, the end of a place, like that in modern terms. It's not nuclear bombs, it's not viruses, it's not zombies and nothing like that. It's literally just, corporations have basically hollowed out a town and left everyone to deal with the dregs. Yeah, that's believable, that sort of thing. And even with that sort of sci-fi edge it has, where it's near future sort of thing, it still feels very sad and unpleasant as a place to be, because it's so grounded in the sort of everyday stuff. It's such a conflicting game to play in that regard, in terms of visually speaking, because on the one hand, everything you see is just horrible and sad and broken and dying. But God almighty, when some of that music kicks in and you see the oil fires going on in the background, and it looks beautiful. It's like, it is just the most beautiful destruction you could see. I think when I reviewed it, I said something along the lines of, it's like a technoir graveyard, as it goes.
Yeah.
And, I'd never been so happy to feel unhappy living in a place like that. I was fully entrenched in what it was doing. And it all comes back to this thing of like being in that grounded sense of why this place is like it is. The explanations are all there behind why it is like this, and there's no easy answers on it, and you have your own personal story to deal with, as well as this just general malaise that's going around the place you've had to return to. And that in itself just, it so quickly pulls you into what it is, and how things are, that it was instantly in my brain. I always say I'm a sucker for good music if it really just does the right thing in setting the scene for a game. And this is like one of my favorite examples. I think you were like the second person to say to me who'd heard the soundtrack before the game, playing the game sort of thing, I think, weren't you? So I remember when I reviewed it, someone else was like, oh, I really want to play it, but listen to the soundtrack loads. It's amazing, that sort of thing. Like most of it's by Gugali, but there's a couple of tracks by Andy G, or whatever it is, the guy who does stuff for Jane Schoenburn, who did We're All Going to the World's Fair and I Saw the TV Glare. Okay. Yeah, so one of his tracks is one of my favourites as well. So, yeah, it's just that perfect kind of doomy, jazzy sort of, I don't want to say Lynchian, but doom jazz is kind of part of a Lynchian style anyway, so that it makes sense that it feels like that. But yeah, I just, it's one of those games in that regard where it's just that whole thing is just burned into my brain when I think about it. It's not just the image, it's the sounds, and the way it moves is, it's ridiculous how that works with this.
Yeah, that score is such a great pairing with the overall sort of like future, near future setting, right? The fact that it has some of that almost old school sensibility to it, but then there's always something to it that just makes it feel a little bit more modern, almost like it's out of place, which I think really complements that setting. And, this game is a great example of like eco horror in that regard, I think, in the ways, yes, in which it dabbles in, Kay's journey, but at the same time dealing with Norco and seeing how this conglomerate has really, soured not only this city and town and the people here, but, quite literally the land itself, right? And you see the ramifications of that. And what's so disturbing about the narrative elements of this game is the fact that, it's not the typical thing where, we're looking for a solution or we're looking for the answers to our questions. We already know the answers to these questions. We already know why all these things are happening, and there's nothing really to be done about it. I mean, it's the same type of thing in, our own time now, where it's like, you see these massive oil spills and things that just completely decimate shorelines and wildlife and, affects the economy in certain regions and whatnot. And okay, you're going to find a company that makes, you know, infinite money every year, right? What's to be done? We already know, like, oh, well, they're not, nobody's going to stop these oil companies from operating in these areas. There's too much money involved. So what do we do? And you just, and it's kind of just like shrug of the shoulders. It's like, hope it doesn't happen again. And, you know, to have a game set around something like that, at first, you know, it could be the type of thing where you're like, well, is this going to actually be like productive in a way, right? Or is it just using this sort of narrative or these themes to just like have this gloom and doom kind of environment? And I think that what allows Norco to sort of circumvent that and to use all of those things, but at the same time have it be enriching from a narrative aspect with these characters and tell a really, I suppose, engrossing story, mystery, whether it's tied to Norco, the town and city and whatnot, or just, you know, Kay's own journey and her history, is the writing. Yeah. You know, this game has really, really fantastic writing for both, you know, the dialogue between characters and their interactions and how personable that can be. At the same time, though, taking a page out of the text adventure influence, where every single thing you click on for the most part has just, you know, really, really well and sort of, I suppose, like sentences and paragraphs and whatnot that just, they give you a sense of place, which so often can get lost, I think. And a big testament to that, I think, is the decision to be this very near future setting, right? Sometimes I think when you talk about sci-fi narratives, sometimes the setting itself can almost be distracting, I think, from the narrative that's trying to be told, because of, you know, there's an overabundance of all this crazy tech. You get lost in, you know, the flying cars and all of these things. But with a game such as Norco, where you can still see a resemblance of, you know, big air quotes, the old world, if you will. I think that that bridges a really interesting gap and a gap between time periods that makes it somewhat more approachable. And it at least makes for the character's own internal sort of struggles and plights resonate more than, you know, getting distracted by, you know, again, the flying cars and whatnot everywhere.
Yeah, it's closer to stuff like Rian Johnson's Looper, you know, in terms of like presenting a futuristic world. You know, there is aspects that are futuristic, but much is the same, you know, because technology and things can move so far, but people tend to move in cycles. And, you know, I think that's one of the most apt things about this game in terms of storytelling about the world as it is. You know, we have that, you know. Look at all this technological advancement. Look at how much it's fucking everything up, you know, sort of thing. And giving, you know, big companies the easy outs to sort of make as much money as they can for as little help as possible and have damaging effects on all types of industry and people. You know, I think, and, you know, one of the things that really sells this as like the living personification of the worst place in any town or city is that, you know, there's rarely a person you meet that could be considered good in Norco. You know, it's like literally only exists because, you know, the most damned and damaged of the residents, you know, are left because what else have they got? You know, they can't leave this place and there's nothing for them. So they're just stuck in this vicious cycle. So obviously when Kay comes back here and knows most of these people like that, it's that sad thing. It's bad enough to return to a town that was already not looking good and now is worse. But to see the people you knew have suddenly just, you know, the effect on them makes it all the more impactful. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, they're not worth your time or empathy. Yeah, I think even the slightest of characters in this game has something about them that adds to this. You know, they all have these visible marks of trauma, you know, on their personality because of what this company has done. You know, and pretty much every story, I think, with these characters has some sort of connection to this story of Kay and Catherine, you know, and these dual stories that they end up telling. And yeah, that's a big part of it, you know, in terms of, you know, it's great to have like lovely looking backdrops and, you know, swoony music, but if the people in it didn't feel like they belonged to it, you wouldn't have anything. You know, you just have a very shallow, pretty looking thing. But no, that these characters make this world. It's like, you know, it's getting all the information you thought you'd need. If you were looking at, you know, a beautiful painting, like a thing like that, and then someone comes along and gives you the context of like, ah, oh, yes, this blah, blah, this, when this happened, and the people who had that. And it's like exposition in a way, but, you know, done in a way that is much more fluent and subtle, I suppose is the best way to put it.
I was, before we were recording, I was reading an article that, an interview that Nicole Carpenter over on Polygon did with Utes, the developer, around the time of this game's release. And I was really interested to learn, and it, you know, explains why this game is able to do what we've just been talking about. The fact that you're able to go into this locale that for the most part is going to be foreign to most people that play this game. And the fact that the characters themselves have they have these signs of trauma, but it's like this industrial trauma or economic trauma from this region, and seeing how that shaped them. But at the same time, they don't necessarily become like cartoon characters, if you will, right? The sort of personification of all of, oh, okay, these are the last remnants of a town, but you still see their humanity, kind of like you had said. And in that interview, what I was reading was the fact that this game basically spawned out of a multimedia project that was more about like an oral history of interviews and archival deep dives and video projects and these things about Louisiana's geography falling like Hurricane Katrina and whatnot. And then, of course, getting into the nitty gritty of, you know, these petroleum companies that are down there and whatnot. And there's a really memorable quote from the developer Utes where he says, you know, the way that he viewed those oil towers and, you know, seeing the fire and stuff, he said it was like growing up around dragons as a kid, because you'd look out and you just see, you know, the fire coming spewing from the tops of them and whatnot. And again, like having that level of personal investment and, more importantly, I think, knowledge of the area and whatnot, it shines through in a way that it doesn't feel like any sort of character depiction or, again, just like the hyperfixation on this specific region and the types of stories that come out of that and the way it's presented. It all feels incredibly believable in a way that, you know, you could only have if somebody themselves, you know, that's involved actually had that sort of personal stake in that place, in those people. And it comes through in the writing in a way that, again, it just, it feels so natural. Cause that's one of the things when I was getting into the game, I was like, this is an interesting setting. I wonder how much this setting is going to actually sort of, be front and center in the terms of that being reflective in the people itself. Right. Or is this just a unique setting that at the end of the day is going to just be a cool setting? Cool is a very loose word to use there. But just like a different setting than you're used to. But at the end of the day, how consequential is it to the actual narrative? Are the people reflective of it? And to find out that that was the case every step of the way, was something that made Norco a game that I enjoyed and loved this game, but at the same time, it was a game that I was thinking about a lot more than I was actually expecting. And it wasn't just the sort of, you know, plot points, if you will, of Kay and Catherine's story. It was more about just like thinking about the world itself and the fact that each of these characters you interact with, no matter if it's a character that is really pivotal to the overall plot or whether it's just a happen chance conversation with somebody in a bar that doesn't end up having much effect on it, everything's adding more flavor to the lore of this place in a way that is so convincing and so concise that within the first hour, I couldn't imagine anybody not being like fully engrossed into this world. Just because of the fact that, again, you know, the writing itself is of a caliber that, again, you want all text-based adventures or point and click games to really strive for. And it's not always the case. And, you know, Norco just really stands out as being like the pinnacle of merging all those multimedia sort of elements, which we'll get into, but at the same time, just the writing itself.
Yeah, I think what helps, especially in what they front load it with, is with Kay's side of the story, is that, you know, she has to find information, you know, in her half of the story all the time. So it means she has to interact with everyone, gleaning any sort of sliver of information she can. And, you know, that in itself then feeds into what you're learning about the place and people's histories with the place. And, you know, because Norco itself is like this now machine, like broken down place, you know, it's like to find anything like humanity in it, no matter what kind it is almost like a little treat. You know, you to find a person in a scene is like, oh, okay, it'd be interesting to see what's going on with them or hear about them. You know, like I said, 9 times out of 10, they're an absolute piece of shit, you know, through circumstance in most cases. But, you know, there's always something to them that is worth listening to. And yeah, it's weird how it does draw you in like that, where, you know, at first you're there for the information, but more and more you just get curious about the people themselves when you see them and you want to sort of learn about how they've been impacted by it. It would have been very easy to sort of have a story where it was very repetitive of, oh yeah, the big company came in and they took Majerb sort of thing, but it's not that. It's very different variants, and not everyone's just about being unemployed. It's just about the social impact, the impact on the environment in general. What can you do in a town that's this shitty? There's a bar here, there's a thing there, that's it, and people either make ends meet or they wallow, and that's it. And there's a strange empathy between the two, like that. It's like there are people who, like, even the people who are wallowing can look at the people who are doing what they can to survive in it and clawing their way out of these odd jobs. Still look at them with kind of pity and empathy because why should anyone have to do this like that? They've kind of given up, so it's a bit different for them. But, and again, that just then feeds through into like the other half of the story, which we learn more about that, and about how the lengths the people are driven to in this new environment, which is, like I said, so beautifully set up, I think, in that opening sort of section before you get to sort of see it from Catherine's perspective.
Yeah, I think it was a really smart move on their part to have it be focusing on the generational ripples of the company's impact within this region rather than the immediate aftermath of it, right? Because then, as you said, it would just be the brunt of the narrative would be people pissed off about losing their jobs or, their livelihoods as a ramification of, basically the petroleum companies like souring the land and whatnot from the, waste dumps and whatnot or leaks. And to more focus on a generation of people that are dealing with the ramifications of that, but at the same time, they've basically accepted it, right? Because again, what is there to be done about this? Basically nothing. And so those characters then, I think, become a lot more interesting, and they become characters that are a little bit more dynamic, I suppose, in the sense that, like you said, people have had to do things to make their, ends meet, basically, as a result of this. And not all of those things have been on the level. And so to meet and sort of interrogate in a certain way, these characters that you're meeting and just like getting to the sort of root of who they used to be. You always see a flicker of who these characters used to be before dealing with all this hardship, which I think is really important because it is always that reminder about like the ways in which you interact with people. You should always lead with like empathy, even if somebody presents something to you that, whether it's something you agree with, whether they're, living their life in a way that maybe they shouldn't be or this or that. It's the type of thing where when you lead with empathy, like understanding how people arrived there ultimately makes for a more interesting character than just, oh, well, I'm the guy that does bad stuff. Like all these characters have a lot more depth to them. And again, every interaction, you're learning not only more about the residents, but you're learning about the region. And in a way, you're learning about K's own history, which I think is just as important. And if not more important than maybe some of the plot beats that go into this narrative, which we can get into a little bit more after the break. But after the break, we're also going to chat about the timeline perspectives of Noriko's narrative. I want to talk about that really fantastic pixel art that's in this game, and at the same time, the ways in which this game is able to have a little bit more interactivity in some mini game ways outside of the sort of typical point-and-click adventure staples. But we'll have more on that in a moment.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free Bright Side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
And we're back from our break and diving right into it. You know, what I was so impressed with the narrative was the fact that it was able to tackle this mystery. It was able to explore Noriko's history, as we mentioned, but at the same time, it's able to play around with the point of view of the timeline, right? Because you have present day as Kay investigating missing brother, but then at the same time, you have flashbacks as Catherine, the mother who passed away. And that was a few months prior to Kay's arrival. Mm. And, you know, that is something that could be very easily, a misstep, I think, in terms of playing around with different points of view in a timeline when you're dealing with this mystery. You know, the idea that you could either reveal too much, you could show your hand too much when jumping back and forth and whatnot. And I really thought that it was handled well, mostly because of the fact that you are, of course, getting two sides to a very complicated relationship. But I think that the writing itself was more focused on the individuals rather than, I suppose, over-explaining some aspects of the narrative or the world itself. How did you kind of feel about the playing around with the timeline?
Yeah, like I said before, like by front-loading it with, you know, the modern present-day stuff for Kay, you know, it really did give us a proper feel and flavor of the world before we get to the flashback, which I think was very important to understand what kind of world then you're going into, where Catherine has to go into it and do these things that she does. And yeah, especially at the beginning, the change in that is that you can then sort of flip the style of the storytelling a bit. There's a kind of otherworldly element to Catherine's side, you know, this, you know, investigating this mysterious thing on the lake, you know, that has caused other people to become obsessed with it as well. And like that, and that in itself is like really fascinating. And you know, for things we won't go into here, because I think it's best to sort of leave it for people to find out. You know, even that kind of feeds into everything we know about, you know, Norco as a place and what's been done to it, and how people, you know, will just turn their attention to things as like some sort of bastion of hope, no matter what it is. And when we sort of flip between the two, you know, and as we go into further into the game, like that, all you've learned in each section is really just accentuating the next. You know, you are adding so much stock to everything that is going on. And you know, it becomes less about the mystery at that point and more about, you know, why is there an estrangement? Why is there all this happening? And yeah, seeing so many different angles between these two timelines of why Norco is so terrible beyond the obvious reasons, like that, and the inevitability of what is coming, especially in Catherine's story. As you already know by that point, that, you know, she's dead by the time, you know, that Kay gets there. So, you know, when you go back at the past, you know that's where we're heading. That's what we're going to find out. You know, the thing we can sort of say here, I suppose, is Catherine, when we know her in the past, is she has cancer like that, but she has, you know, being in Norco, she has little she can do about it. You know, everything's gone to shit, so she has to take on these very dodgy jobs, and that puts her into such weird and wild situations as well, which, it again, we'll get into the sort of, you know, the things that you end up doing and the characters and the gameplay things. But yeah, it felt like a proper distinction between the two. You know, the place really hadn't changed that much between the timelines, because why would it? You know, it's not the point. The point is, you know, Norco is what Norco is. It's really about the people, you know, in either story, but the people are at a different point in their lives in each timeline. So that is where you get the distinction and the change, not in the setting, but in how far degraded the people are.
Yeah, plus, you know, thinking about where both of those characters are at, they are going to be exposed to different parts of Norco based on their situation. which I think is also a really great way to kind of make, I suppose, give the player a 180 view of Norco itself, and this idea that like you can see a seedier side of it perhaps through Catherine's eyes because of what she has to do due to her situation. Whereas Kay, it's a little more straightforward. I'm going to go to these parts of town and interview people. But Catherine's experience is the one where you get to see sort of like underneath Norco, if you will, or you get to see like the nitty gritty aspects of that, that maybe the average person wouldn't, or the average person might not even view as being a standout because they live that experience. Whereas with Kay, who's experiencing some of these things for the first time, and I think it was like 5 or 6 years, she might not have had that same experience with Norco and seeing all these seedier sides to the town and its people and whatnot. But I thought that there was also a really smart distinction in terms of like the gameplay between those two sides of the story that at the very end kind of come together. And that's not just from like the narrative side of things, but at the same time, the types of, I suppose, you know, puzzles and the types of different situations and how they can handle them in different ways based on the abilities at their disposal. So in terms of Kay, you know, she's going to have this ragtag group of people that get together eventually that kind of are going to help her find her brother, but at the same time, you know, investigating the mysteries behind these petroleum companies. And, you know, that's when combat comes into play, which I was kind of taken aback by. At first, I was like, wait, a point-and-click adventure game with like combat, genuine combat? And I thought that that was such a smart inclusion because of the fact that it doesn't drastically alter, I suppose, your typical point-and-click adventure game, because you have these few combat scenarios, but they're based on puzzles that pop up in other aspects of the game. And so, as you'd mentioned, the very first sort of interaction you have in this game is with your old, you know, childhood stuffed monkey. And you get this little mini game where you basically half the time clicking on its eyes at just the right moments. That way you can, you know, lock eyes with it. And that ends up being a factor of combat where you have to play these mini games. And then there's another one where it's like a matching mini game, which again, you know, I'm not going to say like they're the most original approaches to combat, but at the same time, I thought that it offered the player just enough distraction from what they're typically doing in this game, that it was kind of like a nice little dose of variety in terms of what they're doing. And at the same time, it plays around with mechanics that pop up later in the game in different ways as well. So it's kind of like this recycling of mechanics that at the same time adds maybe a little challenge. It's not terribly difficult to get through those combat encounters, but it's just a nice layer of variety, I think, that's included. And then when you have on Catherine's side of the experience, you know, she has a cell phone that she uses in various ways and has apps that help her to solve puzzles and whatnot. And in probably what is one of the best sections of the game, you have to go around and you have the ability to like record lines of dialogue that people have. And then you can use that against them basically to kind of ascertain information from other people or to get through other types of obstacles. And just, again, like the ways in which this game is able to operate within the realm of, again, point and click, at the same time a text adventure, but it's able to attack familiar staples of those genres in really creative and inventive ways. That, you know, was honestly shocking because a majority of the time when I play games such as these, the games are more notable for sort of like the standard things. It's like, oh, it's well-written. It has a great art style. It conveys a really great sense of space and atmosphere and these things. But very rarely do I see developers stepping outside of sort of the norm of what you would expect from those types of experiences with, you know, things that are more involving from maybe a gameplay side of things that enhance rather than, I suppose, alter the expectations for those genres.
Yeah, it really does just do a nice sort of hot pot of genre styles and things that we've seen a lot, actually, as you say, in Horror Byte stuff, where, you know, a lot of the heavy lifting is done by, you know, what happens in terms of like the narrative and like trying to make it very personal and like being very descriptive. Yeah, but obviously this has a few more tools at its disposal, and so you get a bit more about it. Yeah, and I think that's so important that it sort of starts to bleed into different genres like it does, because it stops it feeling like any one thing. You know, so like I said at the beginning, it's like, you know, the point and click for people who don't like point and clicks, because it plays kind of more like a visual novel at times, and it's more like a point-and-click adventure than, you know, it does the little things in between, which it, yeah, there's lots of modern sort of games that do this sort of weird, you know, genre shifts in the indie space. You know, I think Undertale is like one of the most sort of famous examples of like just doing weird things with everything like that. You know, Disco Elysium, I think, is obviously another game that comes into mind in terms of like the way storytelling impacts the way you feel about the game and the way the whether you feel like you're making progress. It's that very tricky thing to do with any game that is very narrative driven, that doesn't have like combat in the traditional sense like that. You still obviously have people who are very wedded to the idea of a video game is a thing where you kill things and either get a high score or upgrades or whatever like that, and it's like, fine, you can see why, you know, that's the predominant thing. That, sports games, shooters, it's all going to be what most people play, you know, in a casual sense. They're not really going to play stuff like this, apart from the people who maybe used to play video games. Go, oh yeah, I used to play Broken Sword or Monkey Island back in the day, and like that sort of thing. It's like, this would be like a really cool entry point to come back to it, you know, where it's like, it has elements of stuff like that, but it's, you know, for a lapsed gamer, if you will, maybe it's a bit more accommodating in what it does, whilst still offering up such great surprises, I think, in terms of what it, as well. And the storytelling is not like those games, sort of reliant on, you know, comedy first and foremost. I think, you know, it's like Broken Sword, even, which is like the more serious one, was, you know, very much like a, you know, G-Chuck sort of comedy game as well. And, you know, a lot of those games were. It makes sense. You know, not all of them, but this one is just so bleak, and maybe that'd be the most off-putting thing. It's like, maybe it's a little too close to home in this day and age, but it is what makes it so distinct, you know? Like, for all the things it does with genre dabbling and structure, it's the fact that it is just so dour and uncaring about, you know, it's not, there's no hope in any of this game, really, when you get boiled down to it from beginning to end. It's, this place is fucked. Everything you do here is really not going to bring any great resolution to Kay. It's just going to give her a kind of closure, and that's it.
Yeah, and I think that that sort of bleakness is why the moments of humor in this game, as absurd as they will be, they worked for me in a really, I don't know how to say it. Like, the humor in this game is, I will say, sparingly used, but when it is used, it always feels like the most appropriate utilization of it, because it's not overbearing, which again, sometimes can be an issue I have with like point and click adventure games from back in the day, where it's like the humor is so overbearing that by the end of it, I'm just like, oh my God, shut up. Like, these jokes have not been funny for the last few hours. And here, this game presents you with, you know, some very absurd moments that had me laugh out loud that I was not expecting. Like, at one point you go to a bodega and you can, you know, play with the bodega cat there, and you know, if you play with it enough, you get this out of this world sort of just randomness that occurs. And as soon as that happened, I was just like dying laughing, because I was like, what, there's no context for this. This kind of defies the, you know, the reality of the situation in a way, or the parameters of the world itself, despite it being a future setting. And yet it just feels totally in line because of the fact that for up until that point, it's like, this is such a dour experience. I mean, I'm looking around and these are basically like walking corpses and whatnot. And then, you know, there's another section where you need to get a secret knock to get into a club. And then you basically have to like help this hot dog vendor that has outdated hot dogs sell his stock and whatnot, just to get a secret handshake or a secret knock. And the knock itself, it has a punchline attached to it. And just like, the use of humor is so perfectly deployed that it doesn't end up making, as dour as this game is, it doesn't make it just feel like this big fucking bummer. Because even though at the end of the day, you know, Kay is looking for answers that are not going to necessarily change her scenario, it's not going to bring Norco back, she's not going to defeat this conglomerate, which I'm so thankful they did not try to make a plot point, right? The idea. This one person and these three other people from around town are just going to like topple this industry. At the same time, though, it's like they make you very invested in her getting the answers that she wants, even if, you know, they might not be the most uplifting of answers, if you will, or revelations.
Yeah, there is nothing that really that she can do at that point, as we said. So, and it's weird. It's like, you know, in any sort of apocalyptic situation, you know, which this is, you know, a localized apocalyptic situation, though it may be, you know, you see these little power grabs that are there, but they're not really going anywhere. You know, like they are just like false sides, you know, like the cult being there and having their own idea, and just, yeah, everyone's beliefs of what they got left very much informed by the world they are in, which, you know, when you say about the humor, it is, you know, it still feels in keeping with the kind of world it is. You know, it's almost gallows humor at times, in terms of the way it's deployed. So it never feels like it's out of place or like, you know, oh shit, this is too depressing, write a joke sort of thing. It is just, I don't know, it's like you are drawn into that, the way of thinking in that world and that atmosphere, so much that when those jokes do come, normally in most normal situations, nah, wouldn't really land or work as a joke or an aside. But because of the world that you are inhabiting and because you are pretty well ensconced in it, it works, you know, and because it feels like a part of that world and it feels natural. And that's, you know, just another reason why it is such an involving experience.
Well, that's kind of like my favorite Endgame recurring gag, which is the Garrets, which is this cult where everybody dons what basically looks like Best Buy employee shirts and everybody goes by Garrett now. And, you know, they're viewed as being this, you know, this like secretive cult, this mythical cult almost. And then when you actually like infiltrate one of their meetings, it's like everybody starts bitching about the quality of their uniforms and the fact that their leader is dressed to the nines. Meanwhile, again, they look like Best Buy employees. Like little things like that, I think, do a great job of grounding a future setting because of the fact that, again, you could get very lost in a far future setting or a near future setting. But the fact that they present you with, you know, androids and robots and these things and the sort of technology that typically goes along with those, you still have people that behave very much like people. Like they're not so influenced by the future and the technology and what benefits and definitely the negatives that go along with that to the degree that they're still not going to argue about the most trivial of things or have power hierarchies amongst themselves and whatnot. And at the end of the day, you know, man's greatest undoing will be himself, right? Those types of things that, you know, they do a great job of having conversations that have a lot of real world sentiment in this more fantastical setting. But at the same time, one does not do a disservice to the other, which again, I think can be very easy to have happen because of the fact that you can get lost in the setting or you try to have a narrative that doesn't match the setting. And in this, it just feels like that perfect merger of the two in a way that it succeeds at conveying exactly what it wants to. And it utilizes, again, this future setting to, if anything, kind of make some of those conversations a little more biting, I suppose, because if anything, it's kind of like, oh, we've got all these advancements and yet we're still dealing with the same problems we've been dealing with for, you know, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that why it's so relatable that the way people try to get around the problems and, you know, that are caused by an outside influence without ever really directing their fury at that problem is to invent new ways to be antagonistic and, right, build your own power base. Again, and very apt in what we see. You know, it's like where in America, in the UK, where you have systems going down the shitter because of, you know, bad business and government, you know, for so many years that, you know, but, you know, certain insidious parts of government will then try and spin it so that it's like, oh, well, it's not our fault. It's the fault of this and this and this. You know, it's like, clearly, it's just, you know, there are other reasons for your misfortune than us. It's like, you know, and sadly, yeah, that's people find that an easier pill to swallow than ever blame the obvious, yeah, and like that, which is a shame. But yeah, it's again one of those reasons this game is just so bloody depressing at times, in a positive way, I suppose.
Well, one aspect that we haven't talked much about is the pixel art style, which I really love. And, you know, this game originally, again, talking about going way back to when it began as a multimedia project that then they had made into sort of like a tech demo almost and trying to make it into a game. And that was a 2D side scroller. And the final product, as anybody that's seen the game knows, is that it's a adventure game, that a point and click adventure game that is done through the first person. And I found that directorial decision to be so incredibly important to sort of further immersing you into the world. Cause you know, you have these really fantastic pixel art settings, basically like canvases of these environments that, you know, are so highly detailed. They've got this great sense of depth to them. And at the same time, you know, there is something gained, I think, in it being from the first person perspective, rather than seeing your character kind of just wander around, wander around from left to right and whatnot. It does a really great job of, I think, putting you sort of like the boots on the ground type of thing, that just furthermore allows you to get sort of engrossed into this world. And if anything, you know, it lets you get a little bit up and closer to, that really fantastic art style. This is one of those games that I knew, of course, that I was going to be a huge fan of, because of course you told me about it and whatnot, on top of it being your game of the year. But I was so happy to get a chance to kind of dive into this a little bit more. And we purposefully skipped over going into the plot, just because it really is the type of game that is best experienced fresh, outside of the sort of broad parameters that we talked about it in.
I think I even said back in my review, it's like, it's something you really do just have to experience for yourself to really get what it is about it. You know, I think it's a testament to the game itself and everything around it, is that that soundtrack is so effective to people even without playing the game. So it says a lot. So yeah, this is it's a special game. It's one of those, when it did come out on console, it was like the arse end of the year at that point. It had already been like celebrated on PC. Like, I think accidentally we've picked the anniversary, the 2-year anniversary of the game.
Funny how that happens.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's unfortunate that we didn't sort of have it earlier in the year to sort of, you know, be appraising it in the way we could have. But hey, here we are. It always gives us an excuse to do an episode down the line at some point.
Yeah. And we can say that next week we'll be chatting about another beloved game of both of ours, and that being Dishonored, a game that, again, somehow we haven't chatted about, but we'll have plenty to say about that and more next week. But until then, my friend, it's been a pleasure chatting horror with you for Safe Room.
And with you, until the next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Safe Room. If you enjoy the show, please rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Safe Room Pod for show updates. As always, our main episodes for Safe Room drop every Monday, but our bite-sized episodes of Horror Bites, our indie horror showcase, drop every Thursday. You can follow Horror Bites' Twitter account at HorrorBites_SR. You can join our Discord channel, Safe Room Podcast, to chat with us and other horror fans about the genre we all love. And finally, you can send emails to saferoompod@gmail.com if you'd like to share your thoughts on a game we have or are going to cover. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you guys next Monday.